Hello and welcome. I am your host, Neil Ward, and I am grateful that you are taking time out of your day to learn more about design educators' paths to tenure. I truly appreciate it. On this episode of Tell It to Neil, we are chatting with Stephen McCarthy, Professor of Graphic Design at the University of Minnesota, St. Paul. Let's listen in. Hi, Stephen. How are you?
Hello, Neil. Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. Thank you for spending time today on Tell It to Neil. Definitely appreciate your time.
This is the highlight of my day. You know, with the pandemic quarantine, this is it.
Good. And just for listeners of the podcast, this is being recorded at the end of June in 2020. So let's get started. So how did you get into graphic design or design?
You know, as an undergraduate, I actually majored in sculpture and drawing. And I took three undergraduate classes in graphic design, but it just didn't appeal to me as a major at the time. So I, took my BFA in sculpture and drawing out into the work world and learned that you don't really find jobs called sculptor, $50,000 a year, must know how to carve wood, stone, you know, cast metal and so on. So yeah. I got a job at Solo Cup Company in Urbana, Illinois, where my late wife was going to college to do her bachelor's. And I became a production artist. It was a pre-computer job, very technical, working with ruling pins and photo set type and stat machines, all those sorts of things. So it paid minimum wage, which was about $3.75 at the time. And I had to wear a shirt and tie to work every day. It was dreadful. I hated it.
Wow.
Yeah. So in the meantime, I took a, I'd already finished my bachelor's at Bradley University in Peoria. And I took a graduate class at the University of Illinois in printmaking. And the professor also worked at the Krannert Art Museum as a preparator. And he had an opening for an assistant. I applied, I got it. So my pay doubled and I got to wear t-shirt and jeans to work.
So much better.
Yeah, exactly. So I did that for 2 years. And then in that job, I was doing exhibition preparation, painting the gallery, doing lighting, typesetting labels, designing some posters. And I started getting interested in the idea of design regarding space and the communication of information and experiences in a museum environment. And so I applied to graduate school to pursue an MFA in design and got into the program at Stanford, which leveraged art and engineering. And so I got to study with, David Kelly and Bill Moggridge and a lot of the sort of all-stars of, 1980s, 90s product design. David Kelly designed the original Apple mouse. He worked with Steve Jobs closely. And anyway, so design for me was kind of through the back door. And I've always, in my personal practice, always had more an art-oriented approach to design rather than like a scientific or a sort of social science approach like many people do. There are many paths into design, and that's my story. That's my path.
Oh my gosh. And what a dream MFA experience.
Like a feeding frenzy. I mean, intellectually, to be, in Silicon Valley in the mid-1980s with all the stuff going on and just the different vocabularies. I was influenced by a lot of the work of the California New Wave, people like April Grimen and Michael Vanderbilt. And, there were a number of Michaels out of the San Francisco design scene, Michael Schwab and Michael Mabry. And there was some great work going on. And also at the same time was when Emigre magazine was beginning in Berkeley, California. And the Emigre Foundry was cranking up with its release of all these interesting type fonts, kind of a new vocabulary for the new era, and I very much embrace that.
Which, and it's so interesting that you're talking about this, and you have a very wonderful scope of graphic design. So doing it when you had to actually cut type out all the way to now we have laptops that do all of that. I would love to be in one of your courses.
Well, thanks. Thanks. And you know, I do work kind of, I do a lot of work on the computer. Obviously we all do, but I also, you know, I work in collage. I cut and paste things. I tear paper. I love the materiality of different materials, textures, processes, you know, so I think I'm lucky in that I'm comfortable and well-versed in things that are off the computer as well.
Absolutely. A handy, handy skill set.
Thanks. Thanks.
So then how did you get to the University of Minnesota from there?
Well, I finished my MFA in 1985, and then I worked for, I guess it's about 4 years in the Bay Area doing commercial graphic design. I also had a position at the Stanford Library designing exhibits and publications. And so I was doing freelance for Silicon Valley clients. I was designing books and posters and exhibits for the Stanford Library. And then I began teaching a typography course at a local community college. And, you know, I couldn't see myself doing the typical corporate work. It just didn't interest me. I didn't feel aligned with the mission of, you know, a lot of sort of the corporate sector. So I pursued an academic path and got a tenure-track job at Northern Kentucky University, 4 miles across the Ohio River from Cincinnati. So my wife and I moved there, and I thought I'd be there a couple of years, you know, kind of building my dossier and then moving on. I was there 9 years, Neil.
Oh, wow.
And you know, and actually, I mean, it was, you know, what I would call sort of a teaching college. You know, it didn't offer a graduate degree. It was focused around undergraduate teaching. It had an open admissions policy. So if you had a diploma from any Kentucky high school, you could get in. So, but you know, I had some amazing students, and they were very interested, and they were very hungry. And it was very rewarding, you know, the years I spent there. You know, some of my graduates have gone on to both academic careers and very successful professional careers. And so it was almost like the expectations there were so low that I could make a big difference. And that's one thing that I miss, and I feel sort of frustrated at the University of Minnesota, because we're so big and fat here that we don't really need the, you know, kind of the hunger, the curiosity. A lot of my current students are, you know, they're maybe second, third generation college students. They very middle class. So I spent 9 years in Kentucky. I got tenure and promotion to associate professor. And then I could see that I was going to outgrow the place after some time. So the opportunity at Minnesota came. I came here as an associate professor. They asked me to go through a short tenure review cycle of a couple of years. And I've been here ever since. So I've been a full professor now for... 13 years, I think. So, yeah, and I'm about to wind it down, Neil. I'm looking to retire in a year or so.
I don't blame you on that.
So if you want my job, look for the opening soon.
So you mentioned there was a couple of years when you arrived at the University of Minnesota that you were kind of on...
probationary status.
Thank you. You just said the word. What did that consist of, or how did that get negotiated?
So they were comfortable with bringing me in at rank, at associate professor rank, but because I had not contributed to a graduate program, and here, you know, we're an R1 school, we're one of the few programs that offers MA, MS, MFA, and PhD in design, and so they really needed to make sure that I was comfortable in a research culture. And also, I'd been in an art department for 9 years, where exhibition was the primary way that faculty disseminated their work. And in Minnesota, I'm in a department that has, I think there are 4 or 5 MFAs, but it's probably 25 PhDs. And so I'm in a culture now where the peer-reviewed journal article is the gold standard, and writing books and book chapters and so on. So I had to prove that I could do that, and I did.
Yes, I've always been curious about the switch going from a teaching institution to a R1 institution and how seamless that is. So that's why I asked the question.
Yeah, I mean, so there are a couple of things. Number one, it's a very different kind of culture. And practical things, like I went from teaching three courses per semester to teaching two. So I was given more time to pursue my research in Minnesota. I was also given more support in terms of, annual travel funds, grants are pretty easy to get to support research. And so, the philosophy here is that you give faculty the tools to succeed and then kind of step out of the way and let them pursue their research agendas. And as long as you come back at the end of the year with a handful of national or internationally disseminated articles, conference presentations, book chapters, exhibits still matter, but I sometimes have to advocate for the what the exhibition venues are like, the rigor of selectivity, impact, and all those things.
All the requirements that go along with an R1 position.
Exactly,
In a good
exactly.
way, in a good
So.
way. I hear that you have reviewed a substantial number of tenure and promotion packets for design professors going up for tenure and promotion and or promotion. How did you get into reviewing those packets?
Once I got to Minnesota, I began to get asked by other institutions. And for this interview, I just counted, and I've done 36 of these over the last 20 years.
Wow.
So typically, I get asked by a department head or a dean if I would review someone. And I'm now kind of limiting them, just because I get asked a lot, and I'm limiting them to people going from associate to full and also peer institutions, so other R1 schools. There are other good people out there that'd be best to look at assistant to associate or people that are at, teaching schools or art academies or different kinds of institutions. So, and when I get asked, I hope that the person asking is familiar with my, not just my scholarship, but sort of my point of view. When they invite me to review someone, they have to be accepting that I'm going to bring to it a certain set of priorities, a certain critical eye, certain values. And so hopefully they're aware of that. I take it very seriously, and I spend a lot of time reviewing the dossier and considering sort of national norms. And so yeah, it's a form of judgment, and it's someone's career in the balance, right?
Absolutely. Well, and for certain institutions, currently I'm at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. And last year I went up for tenure and promotion. And I did earn tenure and promotion at once.
Congratulations, congratulations.
Thank you.
Did they give
And
you a sabbatical year?
I can choose when to take that.
Okay.
I need to get a couple of things in order for that to happen, but I have an idea of what I want to do.
Great, great.
Throughout my process, we have to get external reviews from three graphic design professors to add to our tenure packet to then submit to the department and then to the dean and then to the provost.
Okay. Okay.
I got to choose two, and then I sent a list to my department chair, and then the department chose the other one, yeah, for those reviews. And
Okay.
it's interesting that you say when people ask you to review their work that they need to be aware of your perspective on it because that is really important.
Absolutely, it is. Yep. Well, just to say that at Minnesota, the candidate puts together a list of 10 potential reviewers, and the department head then picks five. Yeah. And once in a while, maybe six letters will come in, or only four, but it tends to be five letters per candidate.
So this is where it pays to network when you're at those international conferences.
It does, but it's also important not to have too close a relationship, so
Oh,
certain
yes.
conflicts, like the reviewer can't have been your former graduate advisor, or they can't be someone that you co-publish with a lot, or they can't be you know, there can't be any conflict of interest around their neutrality and objectivity with reviewing your dossier.
Yes, thank you for bringing those points up.
Sure.
It was such a fine balance to select colleagues that are close, that would know what you're doing, but not close enough that they've, like you said, have been working and publishing with you.
Right.
Definitely a fine line there. So can you walk us through the process of reviewing a tenure and promotion packet? Well, actually, tenure and promotion packet from beginning to end. I'm super curious about this.
Yeah. So it starts with that letter from the department head or dean. And if I accept it, they tend to send a dossier, or these days they put the dossier up on Google Drive or something. And it consists of, you know, the candidate's CV and typically statements around their research, creative production, service, teaching, outreach, and so on. And then examples. So there might be a visual portfolio of works. There might be academic papers they've published. There might be examples of student work. Some even include things like course evaluation scores, or some, you know, sort of narrative statements by students about their teaching. So I look at all that, here's an important thing that not all institutions send, which is their own internal tenure and promotion document. Because that's the yardstick that gets used within the institution.
Yes.
And so they need to state what their standards are, their values, how they count or measure certain things. So if they don't send that to me, then I can sort of use the University of Minnesota document, or I can use my sense of sort of national norms, I would call them. But I do encourage institutions to send out their own internal tenure and promotion document to the outside reviewers. It's very important. So I write a letter that's typically 2 or 3 pages in length, single space, where I make recommendations, I compliment as appropriate, and I criticize as appropriate. Often the question they ask is would this candidate receive tenure and promotion at your institution? And that's a bit tough because, you know, I'm in a design department, not in an art department. And again, as I mentioned earlier, I'm in with a bunch of, my department has sort of artistically inclined designers like myself, but most of my colleagues are social scientists, engineers, humanists, I would call them. You know, they okay. and some of them are even more in, you know, kind of, I don't want to say the hard sciences, although we do have a couple of, like, got a guy with a PhD in engineering from MIT who's very much like does NASA research on wearable technology, and you know, so
how fun.
Yeah, so that's kind of a hard, it's kind of a hard question to answer when asked, you know, would the candidate receive tenure at your institution? And then I've got to sort of do some explaining. I mean, the answer might be yes, but I've got to kind of give context.
Yeah,
so I send my letter off, and that's usually all I hear. I mean, I might be thanked, but sometimes I'll go back on that institution's website the following year just to see whether or not the person got tenure. And I've got to say that most of the letters I write are positive. I have written some that are critical, and I recommend denial of tenure, but most of the ones I write are positive. Most people have earned it, and they deserve it.
Do you think that a person knows if they're going to earn tenure and promotion or not? Like before I was tenured and promoted, mm-hmm. like we had yearly check-ins with the department about, you know, how's your teaching, research, and service going? And there were recommendations at each year. So by about year 3 or 4, I had a really strong idea of if I'm on the right track or I'm not on the right track. So I don't know. I would find that if there were other people that went through that same process, that they would have a feeling whether or not they would actually get through the tenure and promotion process.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
That's come up a number of times. Yeah, yes, it does. In fact, if a candidate gets annually reviewed in a positive way where they're told, you know, you're doing fine, you're on track, and then the tenure vote comes up and they do not get tenure, that actually reflects badly on the institution itself. And it's disingenuous of colleagues to keep, you know, promoting someone along and then deny them tenure. Because the feedback should reflect the reality of how they're doing at the time.
Yeah, I was just curious.
Yeah. And you know, when you asked the question, Neil, I thought you were referring to the sort of confidentiality of the reviewer with the external review process. And at Minnesota, we actually have the right to read the reviewer's letters as they come in. And if a candidate feels that a reviewer is not accurately reflecting their work, that they can write a rebuttal to it. It doesn't go back to the reviewer. It just stays internally in their dossier. But I must say, most institutions I write letters for state that my confidentiality is preserved unless it gets like a court case or something.
Interesting.
Yeah. But in Minnesota, it's a very transparent process. But I think it's a unique process. Most institutions do not have that level of transparency.
I'm going to have to continue to ask that question in further interviews.
Yeah, it is worth asking.
When you're reviewing the tenure and promotion packets, have you ever ran across self-publishing, the candidate trying to make a case that that is research and scholarship?
Well, yes, absolutely. And if you know my work at all, going back 25 years or so, design authorship has been a key part of my practice and research. And so self-publishing is a part of that. But it shouldn't just be sort of vanity publishing. It should be that the self-published work still goes out into the world and goes under some sort of peer review or jury or, you know, editorial process where someone else is still involved with ascertaining, is this thing valuable? Is it good? Is it relevant? Does it add new knowledge to the field? Because if it's just sort of self-publishing for the sake of it, that's like, what's the sound of one hand clapping?
Well, no, it's so funny you mention that because I've been putting articles up on medium.com, and on there they have claps. If you like the article, you just clap.
Or is it just the clap emoji?
It is the emoji.
Yeah.
Especially recently in the past decade, the platforms for self-publishing have just exploded, especially like blurb.com. For that, I would think, and you can comment on this if you'd like, I would think that if you sell a certain number of books on there, that could be a metric for the peer review of it.
Yeah. I mean, dissemination through sales is a legitimate way of disseminating something. If the thing you self-publish is, you know, like whatever the content is, I would look at that too. Like not just sales, but is the content of the blurb book, I don't know, Instagram pictures of your dog, you know, that you made a book out of? Okay, fine. But you know, or is it something with a little more, you know, critical content, you know, that addresses social, political, economic issues? Is it about something a little meatier than just, you know, your own production?
Thank you for that.
Yeah, sure. and there are, I mean, I've made artist books for years, and some of the artist books are very limited edition, kind of handmade, you know, slower production processes and so on, but some have been either offset printed or on demand printed, like through Blurb or Lulu.
Yeah,
and there are venues for distributing and selling these too. There's a store/gallery in New York called Printed Matter that sells artist books and other sort of artist ephemera that's printed. So there are venues for
store.
It. Sure. Yeah. So everything is contextual, Neil. I look at like, does this thing have impact? Where did it go? Who's looking at it? You know, if a lot of the sales are like to your mom, cousins, friends, your students are forced to buy it, that's not the same as something that goes out into the world, you know, that goes into more of a critical context where people can respond to it, collect it, judge it. Yeah, that's how we create new knowledge.
The hook there would be to get another university to adopt the book instead of just your students.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Yep. Yeah, I mean, I've published one mass market book, The Designer As. It was published by BIS Publishing in Amsterdam. And my most recent book, I have not found a publisher. So I wrote a history of the design program at Stanford. And I've had a lot of publishers reject it, and some publishers didn't even have the good manners to reject it. They just stopped responding to my third or fourth email. So I self-published it through Blurb, and it's sold a few dozen copies. But what I'm doing now is I'm mining the book for academic papers. So I'm going back into the text and extracting passages, rewriting them with a little more rigor and citation, and those are going into journal articles. I published one. I've got one that's under review right now. I've got a third manuscript in my laptop ready to send out in a few weeks. So that's how that book will go under peer review, because under Blurb, it's just an artifact that's for sale. Oh,
Got it.
it was also in a nationally juried exhibition. There was an exhibit at, I think it was Florida Atlantic University, Florida International University. I should know this, and we'll edit it right for the published version of the podcast. But
Yes.
there was a show called Looking Good that a faculty member, I believe her name was Stephanie Cunningham, curated, and so the book was in that show as a designed object, not so much for its narrative text, but that's still a dissemination.
And for all those that are listening, the book title is Design at Stanford: A Visual History of Thinking and Doing, in
You
case
are
you want
correct.
to hop on Blurb and purchase it.
Yes, I printed a boutique edition of 65 hardbound books that my university gave me $5,000 to produce.
Oh.
And those were sent out as like proof of concept pitches to publishers. Like, here's what I have in mind. Entire book, 256 pages, full color with the jacket and all that. And so those 65 are that's like a closed edition. It's done. So the version on Blurb is paperback.
Well, you know, maybe it's just not the right time yet for that. Give it like another 5 years. I think people will be all over it.
Well, with the whole interest in design thinking, I mean, design thinking as it's currently packaged originated at Stanford. So the D School and David Kelly's firm IDEO that found a way to package design thinking and sell it to corporate America, the roots go back. I mean, Stanford's design program was founded in 1958, the year I was born. So it's got roots that go back well before the D School, which began in 2005. And so I talk about the faculty, the facilities, the curriculum, the resources. There were some amazing people and things that happened there that are the foundations to our current interest in design thinking. So that's a story I told.
Which is so fascinating. Now, were there any, I'm not great with my history here, were there any masters from the Bauhaus that made their way to Stanford?
No, but there was
Or.
someone who went to Cranbrook. Professor Matt Kahn was at Cranbrook in the 1940s. I mean, he was around Charles Murray Eames. He was around Henri Bertoia. He was around Elil and Eero Saarinen, Marion Strangel, Francis Knoll. I mean, he was around sort of the mid-century all-stars of American design at Cranbrook. Stanford hired him at age 21, without even finishing his bachelor's degree at Cranbrook. And he taught at Stanford for 60 solid years. He became Stanford's senior most professor.
Wow.
His name was Matt Kahn. Google him, you'll be blown away. And he was David Kelly's primary mentor and sort of inspiration.
Oh my goodness, you're you've set my brain just on fire talking about all of those people. They're my favorite people on
Well, good.
the
I'll send you a copy of the book, Neil.
Oh, that would be amazing.
Yeah, sure.
So over the years, over those 36 packets, I imagine that you've reviewed packets from an R1 institution, packets from a teaching institution. What were the main differences there that you saw? And I don't know if you ever reviewed any from a community college. I'm not 100% sure on how that tenure process works.
Yeah,
Because
typically the community colleges don't seek external reviewers. In fact, a lot of the smaller teaching colleges don't seek them either. So it tends to be, comprehensive universities with graduate programs that ask for them. And I'm looking at my CV now, and I've done reviews. I'll just read backwards from this year: Boston
Okay.
University, University of Washington, University of Notre Dame, University of South Australia. North Carolina State University, Virginia Commonwealth University, Qatar Campus, Oklahoma State, University of Michigan, Temple University, University of Florida, University of North Texas, on and on and on. So they tend to be these bigger schools.
Wow. And international.
I've done a couple. Let's see. Nanyang Technological University in Singapore. Yeah, and the University of South Australia. Those might be the two international ones.
Dang. Now, have there been differences between all of those, or have they kind of been similar?
They tend to use the, I mean, I don't know if it's the American model. That would be sort of, presumptuous of me to call it that, because I don't know what other models look like in terms of international universities. But, the idea that the candidate must have effectiveness in teaching, a demonstrated record of scholarship, service to the department and to the university and so on. So I don't know, how they found me or how they've thought I might fit as an appropriate reviewer to their candidate, but I've got a website and it's not too difficult to find me.
Well, are there any specific things that you look for when you're reviewing those packets, or does it pretty much go by whatever the requirements are for the specific institution if they send it?
I probably use the CV as the main record of what they've done. In Latin, curriculum vitae means list of life. And so everything that the candidate has done, ever since graduate school or beginning their academic career is going to be in there. And I must say, I've come across a number of CVs that are not as tight as they should be. They're a little, like they might have a list of things, but they don't have dates. Or they don't say if the thing was juried, reviewed, invited, I look for some pretty descriptive language around, it should be retrievable. So when someone puts something in that they've done, I should be able to go online and say, I'm interested in that article. I want to find out, more about it or whatever. Or that exhibit was, at that museum 3 years ago. Is there a catalog or a website that documents the work? So the CV should be both the list of what they've done, but also the jump-off point to making the work tangible and retrievable, which I'm quoting language from the University of Minnesota's tenure document, tangible and retrievable.
I like those words.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because I've never thought to put down juried, reviewed, invited next to like an exhibition or anything like that. There are things I just never thought of.
Neil, I'm going to send you a document that a couple of colleagues and I produce. That it's the we call it the Design Scholarship Matrix, and you'll see five columns, and it's kind of a roadmap to how scholarship is both created, disseminated, reviewed. What sort of impact it has. So again, I'm in a kind of a diverse department with lots of different scholarly activity. One of my colleagues is a product design professor, designed a kind of a machine for Oreo cookies to split the cookies and melt the icing layer in the middle and then squirt it into his mouth. And the number of YouTube hits on the video of this thing exceeded 1 million. So even though it wasn't a typical work of scholarship, was not a journal article or whatever, it still had impact. If you can get 1 million people to look at anything you've done, that's amazing.
Oh my gosh. And they have a sense of humor too.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, this particular professor, his scholarly focus is in using humor in design, using humor as a methodology for creating. He did a PhD at MIT and did a dissertation on using humor as part of the problem-solving process. So one of my philosophies, Neil, is I think we should have an expansive view of what merits, appropriate scholarship and dissemination in our field. And I'm really interested in things that are, expansive by definition. So they reach new audiences, or they stake out a new point of view, new territory. And I delight in finding things that are not just the standard, she got an article in Visible Language, or he had his poster in Grafis magazine or whatever. I'm interested in things that are like new, different, but also that have rigor and merit.
And that is where the tenure narrative comes in, is explaining mm-hmm. all of that succinctly without being too long-winded.
Absolutely. And that's why each candidate's statement is critical too, because that's a candidate's chance to kind of tell their story, you know, how they've grown, how they've developed, why they think it's important, what contributions they're making. So those are really valuable to the process too.
Absolutely. And it makes me so interested to see how else design can get into places. This past spring, I downloaded one of my favorite comedians' voice file for Waze in the car. Mm-hmm. So every time I get in the car and punch in an address, I get to hear them direct me to where I'm going, and it makes me laugh every time.
Wow.
So what are some pointers you would give for educators assembling their dossiers for review?
I would review it 4 or 5 times before you turn it in. Have a friend or colleague review it, you know, drum out all the typos and all the wonky punctuation, and, you know, so it should be clear, it should be well organized. And frankly, if it's coming from a graphic design professor, it should be typographically high quality. You know, if it's a publication, it should be well designed. The reproductions of the work should be clear and well cropped and well lit. You know what I mean? I can't help it. I look for those things.
Well, we can't help not to as designers.
Yeah. But there again, so formally it should be nice and tight. The content should be rich, clear, again, enough detail so that I can tell, oh, was that work invited into a show by some friends he or she went to grad school with, or did that work go to an independent jury, a national scale exhibition? It was one of 10% juried in, you know what I mean? So I look for things like that that are indications of selectivity, excellence. Yeah.
So what do you do when you ask for those metrics, when you submit something for publishing and the organization just says, well, we don't really have that.
Which is unfortunate, and I think a lot of organizations ought to have it. Some don't, you know, count or care enough to track it. But I'll often ask, I'll follow up, even if I don't get in. I'm just curious, you know. But I can guarantee you that in the sciences and in the social sciences and engineering and so on, they can tell you what their numbers are. And it kind of makes us look a little bit sloppy or a little bit too fuzzy to not know that.
I'm with you on that.
Yeah, I mean, it makes a difference. If your work is 1 out of 10 juried in, that makes it more impressive than if it's 8 out of 10.
So for those of you that are listening, if you're ever on a review panel for papers and whatnot for an organization, definitely bring that point up and see if you can advocate for those numbers or those metrics to be published.
Absolutely. Yep.
How do you think that COVID will impact the tenure and promotion process? Because I know now, like, it's nearly impossible to travel anywhere, to go to a conference, without paying registration fees to go to a conference can't really put something on to pay people to come to it and keynote speak. And how do you think this will impact the tenure and promotion process?
I imagine that we're going to have a year of, you know, almost like a timeout, or a year where we're going to have to say, as a field, we recognize that people have not had the opportunities, that have not had the, you know, invitations or venues. And we just need to, you know, consider a global pause. I mean, maybe for some candidates that means adding another year. So instead of 5 years, you get reviewed after 6 years. Maybe for some candidates it means, well, if we'd hope to, you know, see, I don't know, 25 disseminations over 5 or 6 years, we're going to be happy with 18. You know, I think we have to make accommodations. And we have to be kind and understanding and supportive. But, you know, at the same time, Neil, the pandemic creates creates an opportunity too. And so we're stuck inside a lot, and I've been trying to find ways to make things. And a current creative project I'm working on, I just bought 4 used billboards from a company in St. Paul. The traffic's in billboards that have been up on the side of the highway, and they're you know, graphics and type printed on vinyl. So I bought 4 of these, and I'm cutting them up and rearranging them into, you know, sort of large scale collages using industrial strength adhesives, rivets. Fortunately, vinyl cuts easily with scissors or X-Acto knife, but it's just like, I'm stuck at home here. I got to find something I can do in my basement or my garage, you know? so I encourage faculty everywhere to use the COVID pandemic, you know, the quarantine time to make something, challenge yourself. Oh, I painted a mural in my basement too. I painted a mural that literally says shelter in place. I'll send you a picture of it.
Please do.
Yeah.
So how are you going to get the billboards out of your house?
Well, they're definitely cut into much smaller pieces, and so I'm rearranging them, and you know, but still they're you know, some of the bigger pieces are, you know, 5-6 feet in size, and I'm kind of working to attach them and overlay them, and but to open the full billboard, I do it in my driveway. My neighbors are going by like, what's he up to?
Come on by, add your mark.
yeah. And part of what I want to do is I foresee these things being posted publicly. I mean, the nice thing about the billboard vinyl is it's impervious to rain and snow and sleet and all that. You know, I can put them outside, you know, unlike graffiti or other forms that might be perceived as vandalism or crimes, you can post a vinyl thing and people can take it down if they don't like it.
Well, and it's so interesting that you're talking about that. One of my most prized possessions that I have, that you might get a kick out of this, is a green Freitag bag. And during my graduate degree, we learned about the Freitag bags. And there were these two graphic designs. Are you familiar with this at all?
No, the Freitag, I'm not sure what that is.
So there were two graphic designers, and this was in Zurich. They were looking for a functional water repellent and a decent bag to hold their creative work, and they couldn't find one. They couldn't buy one. So they were inspired by the...
I see it. I'm online now. I can see it.
Yeah, by the traffic in Zurich, and they wound up getting the truck wraps, which is that heavy vinyl, and then they cut them down, or they laundered them to clean them up, and then they cut them up, and they used bicycle inner tubes and seat belts to make these bags, and they are fantastic bags.
Wow. You see the variety online here. Yeah, they look really great. In fact, the company that sold me the billboard said most of how they're used is by companies making bags like this.
And really?
So mostly they're used sort of for their material qualities. You know, the vinyl's super strong.
Yeah.
And I was asking, I want to look at them graphically to see what images are type, but they're all folded up in this warehouse. They said you have to buy them kind of sight unseen. So it's kind of a crapshoot. But still, I'm finding lots of good stuff to harvest out of them.
Well, yeah, the element of surprise. That sounds really exciting.
Yeah. And Freitag, by the way, means Friday in German.
That so I did not know.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, I lived in Germany for many years, so.
Interesting. What were you doing there?
I was there because my father was employed by the Department of Defense as a school principal on an American military base. So I was actually born in France, and we lived a number of places in Germany and 2 years in East Africa. I finished high school at Stuttgart American High School in Germany, and then came back to my own country at age 18 as sort of a foreigner in a way, because I hadn't grown up here. I only lived here 3 years from 0 to 18. And so even though I spoke fluent English and I played baseball and, you know, watched Hollywood movies and so on, I didn't grow up with American TV. And so I had sort of these holes in my cultural understanding that I had to learn. Well, I was like, yeah, sorry,
Interesting.
I never watched Leave It to Beaver. My parents made me go to the Louvre instead.
I was going to say you're probably better off.
Although when my girlfriend and I play the New York Times crossword puzzle, she always nails the answers that have to do with like American pop culture and TV shows and references to certain, I don't know, consumer goods out of the 60s and 70s. And I'm better at the things like geography and culture and stuff like that. So it's fun.
You guys make a great pair to
yeah
do those
yeah yep yep
crosswords.
yep so
Well, if an institution doesn't require outside reviewers for TNP or tenure and promotion, what would you recommend an educator do, especially if they are the only design educator in their department? And I've had to answer this question a lot, actually, which is why I'm doing the podcast. Is to kind of help because this isn't a topic that's widely talked about publicly. It's definitely talked about like person to person, but not publicly. But what would you recommend an educator do if they were in that situation?
Well, so art departments have a culture, and that culture privileges sculpture, photography, painting, mixed media, installation art, on and on. And in their world, the exhibition, especially the solo exhibition or maybe two-person exhibition, reigns supreme. But in graphic design, you don't have a whole lot of one-person exhibition opportunities. For one thing, our work tends to be smaller. It tends to be, handheld or environmental, or it just doesn't translate to the gallery context as well. And so we often have to educate our peers, especially in art departments, as to the value of what we do, why we do it. And fortunately, there are more and more venues that are popping up that acknowledge what graphic designers do, how it's different, how it has its own sort of cultural standards. So again, I was in art department for 9 years, and I had to teach them about other venues for graphic design. Now I'm in a design department, but I'm still exhibiting, so I have to teach my PhD colleagues about the value of the juried exhibition. So it's always like opportunities to educate our peers and to prove our rigor, our relevancy. And if you can keep showing that it goes under jury or peer review, there are others out there that think your work is meritorious.
Well said. Thank
Well,
you for
thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
that.
Yeah, edit as you please, Neil. There are probably a lot of words in here that could be chopped out.
Yes. Oh, don't worry. I spend quite a large amount of time editing out all of my sows and everything else, little pauses and whatnot. I've tried to get better at this, and I'm like, I'm just gonna have to leave that to to editing afterwards.
Sure.
Would you recommend that those educators ask for external letters if they're not required?
Sure. I've been asked to write some that were not required, like the candidate has approached me as opposed to their chair or dean. And they said, my department doesn't require it, but would you mind writing a letter of support? And so I've done that a number of times. Not 3 or 4 times, maybe.
That seems to be more popular now is having a lot of adjuncts in a department and only maybe one or two tenure track faculty.
That's because it's cheaper for the university to have the adjuncts, and that way they can pay their administrators more money. Yeah, don't get me started.
I feel like that's another interview.
Exactly. Yeah.
should do like a dark web interview about all the underlying currents at institutions. Everyone's anonymous and I can like warp voices, but just to get these like stories and opinions without actually harming anybody.
Exactly. And then you know how like in your iTunes where it has your playlist and then it has like the explicit tag for
Yes.
songs. We'll have explicit tags on those.
My God. gosh. I love it.
Yeah.
Well, we're nearing the end of our interview. Are there any parting thoughts or any upcoming projects you would like to talk about that you haven't yet?
Yeah. You know, I've been at this now for 31 years, and it's been rewarding, and, you know, it's morphing continuously. You know, yeah, so I sort of see my role as a, you know, kind of a, you know, a senior member of the faculty who, I'd like to be a resource for people, you know, to mentor people, to, you know, this kind of podcast is exactly the kind of thing I enjoy doing, because I get to share the stories and the, you know, my own travels and experiences and seeing the field evolve over a few decades. One thing I'm really pleased to have done recently was, do you know the group Design Incubation out of New York?
I do. Yes.
Well, I helped them found a design educators, communication design educators award, because most other fields out there, product design, interior design, apparel design, architecture, they all have awards for educators, and graphic design did not have any. And I approached the AIGA with this initially, and they thought about it and eventually didn't buy it. So I approached Design Incubation and met with sort of the enthusiastic and supportive environment there. And this is now the fifth year of the award. And we provide awards in scholarship, both published research and creative production, in teaching and in service. And so something like your podcast would be sort of like fit into that kind of service category, where you're doing service to the profession by having these interviews. And, you know, it's not explicitly teaching, it's not explicitly research, but still it's service, you know. So those awards are to help people find a forum or a venue to put their work in. So that's, you know, part of the legacy I'm leaving.
And thank you so much for that legacy as well.
Well, thank you. And good luck taking it forward.
Thank you, Ed. I enjoy interviewing and I enjoy getting stories, so I don't think I'll stop anytime soon.
No, I think it's great. I think it's great, Neil. I'd say keep doing what you're doing, and you know, as you expand your roster of people you interview, you know, I'm happy to give you names of people that might add other insights.
Oh, that would be great. Yeah, thank you.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for your time today, too.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and enjoy the rest of the summer.
I certainly will. You as well. This concludes Season 2, Episode 10 of Tell It to Neil. If any of the facts or information included in this episode are incorrect, please feel free to get in touch through our email, hello@tellittoneil.com. If you would like to get in touch with Stephen, please contact him through email at smccarthy@umn.edu.